Unexpectedly, Billy Pilgrim found himself upset by the song and the occasion. He had never had an old gang, old sweethearts and pals, but he missed one anyway, as the quartet made slow, agonized experiments with chords. Chords intentionally sour, sour still, unbearably sour, and then a chord that was suffocatingly sweet, and then some sour ones again. Billy had powerful psychosomatic responses to the changing chords. His mouth filled with the taste of lemonade, and his face became grotesque, as though he really were being stretched on the torture engine called the rack. He looked so peculiar that several people commented on it solicitously when the song was done. They thought he might have been having a heart attack, and Billy seemed to confirm this by going to a chair and sitting down haggardly. There was silence. "Oh my God," said Valencia, leaning over him. "Billy, are you all right?"
"Yes."
"You look so awful."
"Really, I'm okay." And he was, too, except that he could find no explanation for why the song had affected him so grotesquely. He had supposed for years that he had no secrets from himself. Here was proof that he had a great big secret somewhere inside, and he could not imagine what it was. People drifted away now, seeing the color return to Billy's cheeks, seeing him smile. Valencia stayed with him, and Kilgore Trout, who had been on the fringe of the crowd, came closer, interested, shrewd.
"You looked as though you'd seen a ghost," said Valencia.
"No," said Billy. He hadn't seen anything but what was really before him, the faces of the four singers, those four ordinary men, cow-eyed and mindless and anguished, as they went from sweetness to sourness to sweetness again. "Can I make a guess?" said Kilgore Trout. "You saw through a time window."
"A what?" said Valencia.
"He suddenly saw the past or the future, am I right?"
"No," said Billy Pilgrim.
He got up, put a hand into his pocket, found the box containing the ring in there. He took out the box, gave it absently to Valencia. He had meant to give it to her at the end of the song, while everybody was watching. Only Kilgore Trout was there to see.
"For me?" said Valencia.
"Yes."
"Oh my God," she said.
Then she said it louder, so other people heard. They gathered around, and she opened it, and she almost screamed when she saw the sapphire with a star in it.
"Oh my God," she said.
She gave Billy a big kiss. She said,
"Thank you, thank you, thank you."
There was a lot of talk about what wonderful jewelry Billy had given to Valencia over the years.
"My God," said Maggie White.
"She's already got the biggest diamond I ever saw outside of a movie." She was talking about the diamond Billy had brought back from the war. The partial denture he had found inside his little impresario's coat, incidentally, was in his cufflinks box in his dresser drawer. Billy had a wonderful collection of cufflinks. It was the custom of the family to give him cufflinks on every Father's Day. He was wearing Father's Day cufflinks now. They had cost over $100. They were made out of ancient Roman coins. He had one pair of cufflinks upstairs, which were little roulette wheels that really worked. He had another pair, which had a real thermometer in one and a real compass in the other. Billy now moved about the party, outwardly normal. Kilgore Trout was shadowing him, keen to know what Billy had suspected or seen. Most of Trout's novels, after all, dealt with time warps and extrasensory perception and other unexpected things. Trout believed in things like that, was greedy to have their existence proved. "You ever put a full-length mirror on the floor and then have a dog stand on it?" Trout asked Billy.
"No."
"The dog will look down, and all of a sudden he'll realize there's nothing under him. He thinks he's standing on thin air. He'll jump a mile."
"He will?"
"That's how you looked, as though you all of a sudden realized you were standing on thin air." The barbershop quartet sang again. Billy was emotionally racked again. The experience was definitely associated with those four men and not what they sang. Here is what they sang while Billy was pulled apart inside. 11-cent cotton, 40-cent meat. How in the world can a poor man eat? Pray for the sunshine, 'cause it will rain. Things getting worse, driving all insane. Built a nice bar, painted it brown. Lightning came along and burnt it down. No use talking, any man's beat, with 11-cent cotton and 40-cent meat. 11-cent cotton, a carload of tax, the load's too heavy for our poor backs. And so on. Billy fled upstairs in his nice white home. Trout would have come upstairs with him if Billy hadn't told him not to. Then Billy went into the upstairs bathroom, which was dark. He closed and locked the door. He left it dark and gradually became aware that he was not alone. His son was in there. "Dad," his son said in the dark. Robert, the future Green Beret, was 17 then. Billy liked him, but didn't know him very well. Billy couldn't help suspecting that there wasn't much to know about Robert. Billy flicked on the light. Robert was sitting on the toilet with his pajama bottoms around his ankles. He was wearing an electric guitar slung around his neck on a strap. He had just bought the guitar that day. He couldn't play it yet, and in fact, never learned to play it. It was a nacreous pink. "Hello, son," said Billy Pilgrim. Billy went into his bedroom, even though there were guests to be entertained downstairs. He lay down in his bed, turned on the magic fingers. The mattress trembled, drove a dog out from under the bed. The dog was Spot. Good old Spot was still alive in those days. Spot lay down again in a corner. Billy thought hard about the effect the quartet had had on him, and then found an association with an experience he had had long ago. He did not travel in time to the experience. He remembered it shimmeringly, as follows. He was down in the meat locker on the night that Dresden was destroyed. There were sounds like giant footsteps above. Those were sticks of high explosive bombs. The giants walked and walked. The meat locker was a very safe shelter. All that happened down there was an occasional shower of calcimine. The Americans and four of their guards and a few dressed carcasses were down there, and nobody else. The rest of the guards had, before the raid began, gone to the comforts of their own homes in Dresden. They were all being killed with their families. So it goes. The girls that Billy had seen naked were all being killed, too, in a much shallower shelter in another part of the stockyards. So it goes. A guard would go to the head of the stairs every so often to see what it was like outside. Then he would come down and whisper to the other guards. There was a firestorm out there. Dresden was one big flame. The one flame ate everything organic, everything that would burn. It wasn't safe to come out of the shelter until noon the next day. When the Americans and their guards did come out, the sky was black with smoke. The sun was an angry little pinhead. Dresden was like the moon now, nothing but minerals. The stones were hot. Everybody else in the neighborhood was dead. So it goes. The guards drew together instinctively, rolled their eyes. They experimented with one expression and then another, said nothing, though their mouths were often open. They looked like a silent film of a barbershop quartet. So long forever they might have been singing, old fellows and pals. So long forever, old sweethearts and pals. God bless 'em. "Tell me a story," Montana Wildhack said to Billy Pilgrim in the Tralfamadorian Zoo one time. They were in bed side by side. They had privacy. The canopy covered the dome. Montana was 6 months pregnant now, big and rosy, lazily demanding small favors from Billy from time to time. She couldn't send Billy out for ice cream or strawberries, since the atmosphere outside the dome was cyanide, and the nearest strawberries and ice cream were millions of light years away. She could send him to the refrigerator, which was decorated with the blank couple on the bicycle built for two. Or, as now, she could wheedle, "Tell me a story, Billy boy." Dresden was destroyed on the night of February 13, 1945, Billy Pilgrim began. "We came out of our shelter the next day." He told Montana about the four guards who, in their astonishment and grief, resembled a barbershop quartet. He told her about the stockyards with all the fence posts gone, with roofs and windows gone. Told her about seeing little logs lying around. There were people who had been caught in the firestorm. So it goes. Billy told her what had happened to the buildings that used to form cliffs around the stockyards. They had collapsed. Their wood had been consumed, and their stones had crashed down, had tumbled against one another until they locked at last in low and graceful curves. It was like the moon, said Billy Pilgrim. The guards told the Americans to form in ranks of four, which they did. Then they had them march back to the hog barn, which had been their home. Its walls still stood, but its windows and roof were gone, and there was nothing inside but ashes and dollops of melted glass. It was realized then that there was no food or water, and that the survivors, if they were going to continue to survive, were going to have to climb over curve after curve on the face of the moon, which they did. The curves were smooth only when seen from a distance. The people climbing them learned that they were treacherous, jagged things, hot to the touch, often unstable, eager, should certain important rocks be disturbed, to tumble some more to form lower, more solid curves. Nobody talked much as the expedition crossed the moon. There was nothing appropriate to say. One thing was clear. Absolutely everybody in the city was supposed to be dead, regardless of what they were, and that anybody that moved in it represented a flaw in the design. There were to be no moon men at all. American fighter planes came in under the smoke to see if anything was moving. They saw Billy and the rest moving down there. The planes sprayed them with machine gun bullets, but the bullets missed. Then they saw some other people moving down by the riverside, and they shot at them. They hit some of them. So it goes. The idea was to hasten the end of the war. Billy's story ended very curiously in a suburb untouched by fire and explosions. The guards and the Americans came at nightfall to an inn which was open for business. There was candlelight. There were fires in three fireplaces downstairs. There were empty tables and chairs waiting for anyone who might come, and empty beds with covers turned down upstairs. There was a blind innkeeper and his sighted wife, who was the cook, and their two young daughters, who worked as waitresses and maids. This family knew that Dresden was gone. Those with eyes had seen it burn and burn, understood that they were on the edge of a desert now. Still, they had opened for business, had polished the glasses, and wound the clocks, and stirred the fires, and waited to see who had come. There was no great flow of refugees from Dresden. The clocks ticked on, the fires crackled, the translucent candles dripped. And then there was a knock on the door, and in came four guards and 100 American prisoners of war. The innkeeper asked the guards if they had come from the city. Yes. Are there more people coming? And the guards said that, on the difficult route they had chosen, they had not seen another living soul. The blind innkeeper said that the Americans could sleep in his stable that night, and he gave them soup and ersatz coffee and a little beer. Then he came out to the stable to listen to them bedding down in the straw. Good night, Americans, he said in German. Sleep well. Chapter 9. Here is how Billy Pilgrim lost his wife, Valencia. He was unconscious in the hospital in Vermont after the airplane crash on Sugarbush Mountain, and Valencia, having heard about the crash, was driving from Ilium to the hospital in the family Cadillac Eldorado Coupe de Ville. Valencia was hysterical, because she had been told frankly that Billy might die, or that, if he lived, he might be a vegetable. Valencia adored Billy. She was crying and yelping so hard as she drove that she missed the correct turnoff from the throughway. She applied her power brakes, and a Mercedes slammed into her from behind. Nobody was hurt, thank God, because both drivers were wearing seatbelts. Thank God, thank God. The Mercedes lost only a headlight, but the rear end of the Cadillac was a body and fender man's wet dream. The trunk and fenders were collapsed. The gaping trunk looked like the mouth of a village idiot who was explaining that he didn't know anything about anything. The fenders shrugged. The bumper was at a high port arms. Reagan for president, a sticker on the bumper said. The back window was veined with cracks. The exhaust system rested on the pavement. The driver of the Mercedes got out and went to Valencia to find out if she was all right. She blabbed hysterically about Billy and the airplane crash, and then she put her car in gear and crossed the median divider, leaving her exhaust system behind. When she arrived at the hospital, people rushed to the windows to see what all the noise was. The Cadillac, with both mufflers gone, sounded like a heavy bomber coming in on a wing in a prayer. Valencia turned off the engine, but then she slumped against the steering wheel, and the horn brayed steadily. A doctor and a nurse ran out to find out what the trouble was. Poor Valencia was unconscious, overcome by carbon monoxide. She was a heavenly azure. 1 hour later, she was dead. So it goes. Billy knew nothing about it. He dreamed on and traveled in time and so forth. The hospital was so crowded that Billy couldn't have a room to himself. He shared a room with a Harvard history professor named Bertram Copeland Rumford. Rumford didn't have to look at Billy, because Billy was surrounded by white linen screens on rubber wheels, but Rumford could hear Billy talking to himself from time to time. Rumford's left leg was in traction. He had broken it while skiing. He was 70 years old, but had the body and spirit of a man half that age. He had been honeymooning with his fifth wife when he broke his leg. Her name was Lily. Lily was 23. Just about the time poor Valencia was pronounced dead, Lily came into Billy's and Rumford's room with an armload of books. Rumford had sent her down to Boston to get them. He was working on a one-volume history of the United States Army Air Corps in World War II. The books were about bombings and sky battles that had happened before Lily was even born. "You guys go on without me," said Billy Pilgrim deliriously as pretty little Lily came in. She had been an a-go-go girl when Rumford saw her and resolved to make her his own. She was a high school dropout. Her IQ was 103. "He scares me," she whispered to her husband about Billy Pilgrim. "He bores the hell out of me," Rumford replied boomingly. "All he does in his sleep is quit and surrender and apologize and ask to be left alone." Rumford was a retired brigadier general in the Air Force Reserve, the official Air Force historian, a full professor, the author of 26 books, a multimillionaire since birth, and one of the great competitive sailors of all time. His most popular book was about sex and strenuous athletics for men over 65. Now he quoted Theodore Roosevelt, whom he resembled a lot. "I could carve a better man out of a banana." One of the things Rumford had told Lily to get in Boston was a copy of President Harry S. Truman's announcement to the world that an atomic bomb had been dropped on Hiroshima. She had a Xerox of it, and Rumford asked her if she had read it. "No." She didn't read well, which was one of the reasons she had dropped out of high school. Rumford ordered her to sit down and read the Truman Statement now. He didn't know that she couldn't read much. He knew very little about her, except that she was one more public demonstration that he was a Superman. So Lily sat down and pretended to read the Truman thing, which went like this. 16 hours ago, an American airplane dropped one bomb on Hiroshima, an important Japanese army base. That bomb had more power than 20,000 tons of TNT. It had more than 2,000 times the blast power of the British Grand Slam, which is the largest bomb ever yet used in the history of warfare. The Japanese began the war from the air at Pearl Harbor. They have been repaid manyfold, and the end is not yet. With this bomb, we have now added a new and revolutionary increase in destruction to supplement the growing power of our armed forces. In their present form, these bombs are now in production, and even more powerful forms are in development. It is an atomic bomb. It is a harnessing of the basic power of the universe. The force from which the sun draws its power has been loosed against those who brought war to the Far East. Before 1939, it was the accepted belief of scientists that it was theoretically possible to release atomic energy, but nobody knew any practical method of doing it.
By 1942, however, we knew that the Germans were working feverishly to find a way to add atomic energy to all the other engines of war with which they hoped to enslave the world. But they failed. We may be grateful to Providence that the Germans got the V-1s and V-2s late and in limited quantities, and even more grateful that they did not get the atomic bomb at all. The Battle of the Laboratories held fateful risks for us as well as the battles of the air, land, and sea, and we have now won the Battle of the Laboratories as we have won the other battles. We are now prepared to obliterate more rapidly and completely every productive enterprise the Japanese have above ground in any city, said Harry Truman. We shall destroy their docks, their factories, and their communications. Let there be no mistake. We shall completely destroy Japan's power to make war. It was to spare, and so on. One of the books that Lily had brought Rumford was The Destruction of Dresden by an Englishman named David Irving. It was an American edition published by Holt, Reinhardt, and Winston in 1964. What Rumford wanted from it were portions of the forewords by his friends Ira C. Aker, Lieutenant General, USAF, retired, and British Air Marshal Sir Robert Sonby, KCB, KBE, MC, DFC, AFC. I find it difficult to understand Englishmen or Americans who weep about enemy civilians who were killed, but who have not shed a tear for our gallant crews lost in combat with a cruel enemy, wrote his friend General Aker in part. I think it would have been well for Mr. Irving to have remembered, when he was drawing the frightful picture of the civilians killed at Dresden, that V-1s and V-2s were at the very time falling on England, killing civilian men, women, and children indiscriminately, as they were designed and launched to do. It might be well to remember Buchenwald and Coventry, too. Aker's foreword ended this way. I deeply regret that British and U.S. bombers killed 135,000 people in the attack on Dresden, but I remember who started the last war, and I regret even more the loss of more than 5 million Allied lives in the necessary effort to completely defeat and utterly destroy Nazism. So it goes. What Air Marshal Sonby said, among other things, was this. That the bombing of Dresden was a great tragedy, none can deny. That it was really a military necessity, few, after reading this book, will believe. It was one of those terrible things that sometimes happen in wartime, brought about by an unfortunate combination of circumstances. Those who approved it were neither wicked nor cruel, though it may well be that they were too remote from the harsh realities of war to understand fully the appalling destructive power of air bombardment in the spring of 1945. The advocates of nuclear disarmament seemed to believe that, if they could achieve their aim, war would become tolerable and decent. They would do well to read this book and ponder the fate of Dresden, where 135,000 people died as the result of an air attack with conventional weapons. On the night of March 9, 1945, an air attack on Tokyo by American heavy bombers using incendiary and high-explosive bombs caused the death of 83,793 people. The atom bomb dropped on Hiroshima killed 71,379 people. So it goes. If you're ever in Cody, Wyoming, said Billy Pilgrim behind his white linen screens, just ask for Wild Bob. Lily Rumford shuddered, went on pretending to read the Harry Truman thing. Billy's daughter Barbara came in later that day. She was all doped up, had the same glassy-eyed look that poor old Edgar Derby wore just before he was shot in Dresden. Doctors had given her pills so she could continue to function, even though her father was broken and her mother was dead. So it goes. She was accompanied by a doctor and a nurse. Her brother Robert was flying home from a battlefield in Vietnam. "Daddy?" she said tentatively. "Daddy?" But Billy was 10 years away, back in 1958. He was examining the eyes of a young male Mongolian idiot in order to prescribe corrective lenses. The idiot's mother was there, acting as an interpreter. "How many dots do you see?" Billy Pilgrim asked him.
And then Billy traveled in time to when he was 16 years old, in the waiting room of a doctor. Billy had an infected thumb. There was only one other patient waiting, an old, old man. The old man was in agony because of gas. He farted tremendously, and then he belched.
"Excuse me," he said to Billy. Then he did it again. "Oh, God," he said. "I knew it was going to be bad getting old." He shook his head. "I didn't know it was going to be this bad."
Billy Pilgrim opened his eyes in the hospital in Vermont, did not know where he was. Watching him was his son, Robert. Robert was wearing the uniform of the famous Green Berets. Robert's hair was short, with wheat-colored bristles. Robert was clean and neat. He was decorated with a purple heart and a silver star and a bronze star with two clusters. This was a boy who had flunked out of high school, who had been an alcoholic at 16, who had run with a rotten bunch of kids, who had been arrested for tipping over hundreds of tombstones in a Catholic cemetery one time. He was all straightened out now. His posture was wonderful, and his shoes were shined, and his trousers were pressed, and he was a leader of men.
"Dad." Billy Pilgrim closed his eyes again.
Billy had to miss his wife's funeral because he was still so sick. He was conscious, though, while Valencia was being put into the ground in Ilium. Billy hadn't said much since regaining consciousness, hadn't responded very elaborately to the news of Valencia's death and Robert's coming home from the war and so on, so it was generally believed that he was a vegetable. There was talk of performing an operation on him later, one which might improve the circulation of blood to his brain. Actually, Billy's outward listlessness was a screen. The listlessness concealed a mind which was fizzing and flashing thrillingly. It was preparing letters and lectures about the flying saucers, the negligibility of death, and the true nature of time. Professor Rumford said frightful things about Billy within Billy's hearing, confident that Billy no longer had any brain at all.
"Why don't they let him die?" he asked Lily.
"I don't know," she said.
"It's not a human being anymore. Doctors are for human beings. They should turn him over to a veterinarian or a tree surgeon. They'd know what to do. Look at him. That's life, according to the medical profession. Isn't life wonderful?"
"I don't know," said Lily.
Rumford talked to Lily about the bombing of Dresden one time, and Billy heard it all. Rumford had a problem about Dresden. His one-volume history of the Army Air Force in World War II was supposed to be a readable condensation of the 27-volume official history of the Army Air Force in World War II. The thing was, though, there was almost nothing in the 27 volumes about the Dresden Raid, even though it had been such a howling success. The extent of the success had been kept a secret for many years after the war, a secret from the American people. It was no secret from the Germans, of course, or from the Russians who occupied Dresden after the war, who are in Dresden still.
"Americans have finally heard about Dresden," said Rumford, 23 years after the raid. "A lot of them know now how much worse it was than Hiroshima, so I've got to put something about it in my book. From the official Air Force standpoint, it'll all be new."
"Why would they keep it a secret so long?" said Lily.
"For fear that a lot of bleeding hearts," said Rumford, "might not think it was such a wonderful thing to do."
It was now that Billy Pilgrim spoke up intelligently. "I was there," he said. It was difficult for Rumford to take Billy seriously, since Rumford had so long considered Billy a repulsive non-person who would be much better off dead. Now, with Billy speaking clearly and to the point, Rumford's ears wanted to treat the words as a foreign language that was not worth learning.
"What did he say?" said Rumford.
Lily had to serve as an interpreter.
"He said he was there," she explained.
"He was where?"
"I don't know," said Lily. "Where were you?" she asked Billy.
"Dresden," said Billy.
"Dresden," Lily told Rumford.
"He's simply echoing things we say," said Rumford.
"Oh," said Lily.
"He's got echolalia now."
"Oh."
Echolalia is a mental disease which makes people immediately repeat things that well people around them say. But Billy didn't really have it.
Rumford simply insisted, for his own comfort, that Billy had it. Rumford was thinking in a military manner, that an inconvenient person, one whose death he wished for very much, for practical reasons, was suffering from a repulsive disease. Rumford went on insisting for several hours that Billy had echolalia, told nurses and a doctor that Billy had echolalia now. Some experiments were performed on Billy. Doctors and nurses tried to get Billy to echo something, but Billy wouldn't make a sound for them. "He isn't doing it now," said Rumford peevishly. "The minute you go away, he'll start doing it again." Nobody took Rumford's diagnosis seriously. The staff thought Rumford was a hateful old man, conceited and cruel. He often said to them, in one way or another, that people who were weak deserved to die, whereas the staff, of course, was devoted to the idea that weak people should be helped as much as possible, that nobody should die. There in the hospital, Billy was having an adventure very common among people without power in time of war. He was trying to prove to a willfully deaf and blind enemy that he was interesting to hear and see. He kept silent until the lights went out at night, and then, when there had been a long period of silence containing nothing to echo, he said to Rumford, "I was in Dresden when it was bombed. I was a prisoner of war." Rumford sighed impatiently. "Word of honor," said Billy Pilgrim. "Do you believe me?" "Must we talk about it now?" said Rumford. He had heard. He didn't believe. "We don't ever have to talk about it," said Billy. "I just want you to know. I was there." Nothing more was said about Dresden that night, and Billy closed his eyes, traveled in time to a May afternoon, 2 days after the end of the Second World War in Europe. Billy and five other American prisoners were riding in a coffin-shaped green wagon, which they had found abandoned, complete with two horses, in a suburb of Dresden. Now they were being drawn by the clop-clop-clopping horses down narrow lanes, which had been cleared through the moon-like ruins. They were going back to the slaughterhouse for souvenirs of the war. Billy was reminded of the sounds of milkmen's horses early in the morning in Ilium when he was a boy. Billy sat in the back of the jiggling coffin. His head was tilted back and his nostrils were flaring. He was happy. He was warm. There was food in the wagon and wine and a camera and a stamp collection and a stuffed owl and a mantle clock that ran on changes of barometric pressure. The Americans had gone into empty houses in the suburbs where they had been imprisoned, and they had taken these and many other things. The owners, hearing that the Russians were coming, killing and robbing and raping and burning, had fled. But the Russians hadn't come yet, even 2 days after the war. It was peaceful in the ruins. Billy saw only one other person on the way to the slaughterhouse. It was an old man pushing a baby buggy. In the buggy were pots and cups and an umbrella frame and other things he had found. Billy stayed in the wagon when it reached the slaughterhouse, sunning himself. The others went looking for souvenirs. Later on in life, the Tralfamadorians would advise Billy to concentrate on the happy moments of his life and to ignore the unhappy ones, to stare only at pretty things as eternity failed to go by. If this sort of selectivity had been possible for Billy, he might have chosen as his happiest moment his sun-drenched snooze in the back of the wagon. Billy Pilgrim was armed as he snoozed. It was the first time he had been armed since basic training. His companions had insisted that he arm himself, since God only knew what sort of killers might be in burrows on the face of the moon. Wild dogs, packs of rats fattened on corpses, escaped maniacs and murderers, soldiers who would never quit killing until they themselves were killed. Billy had a tremendous cavalry pistol in his belt. It was a relic of World War I. It had a ring in its butt. It was loaded with bullets the size of robin's eggs. Billy had found it in the bedside table in a house. That was one of the things about the end of the war. Absolutely anybody who wanted a weapon could have one. They were lying all around. Billy had a saber, too. It was a Luftwaffe ceremonial saber. Its hilt was stamped with a screaming eagle. The eagle was carrying a swastika and looking down. Billy found it stuck into a telephone pole. He had pulled it out of the pole as the wagon went by. Now his snoozing became shallower as he heard a man and a woman speaking German in pitying tones.
The speakers were commiserating with somebody lyrically. Before Billy opened his eyes, it seemed to him that the tones might have been those used by the friends of Jesus when they took his ruined body down from his cross. So it goes. Billy opened his eyes. A middle-aged man and wife were crooning to the horses. They were noticing what the Americans had not noticed, that the horses' mouths were bleeding, gashed by the bits, that the horses' hooves were broken, so that every step meant agony, that the horses were insane with thirst. The Americans had treated their form of transportation as though it were no more sensitive than a six-cylinder Chevrolet. These two horse pitiers moved back along the wagon to where they could gaze in patronizing reproach at Billy Pilgrim, who was so long and weak, so ridiculous in his azure toga and silver shoes. They weren't afraid of him. They weren't afraid of anything. They were doctors, both obstetricians. They had been delivering babies until the hospitals were all burned down. Now they were picnicking near where their apartment used to be. The woman was softly beautiful, translucent from having eaten potatoes for so long. The man wore a business suit, necktie and all. Potatoes had made him gaunt. He was as tall as Billy, steel-rimmed trifocals. This couple, so involved with babies, had never reproduced themselves, though they could have. This was an interesting comment on the whole idea of reproduction. They had 9 languages between them. They tried Polish on Billy Pilgrim first, since he was dressed so clownishly, since the wretched Poles were the involuntary clowns of the Second World War. Billy asked them in English what it was they wanted, and they at once scolded him in English for the condition of the horses. They made Billy get out of the wagon and come look at the horses. When Billy saw the condition of his means of transportation, he burst into tears. He hadn't cried about anything else in the war. Later on, as a middle-aged optometrist, he would weep quietly and privately sometimes, but never make loud boo-hooing noises. Which is why the epigraph of this book is a quatrain from the famous Christmas Carol. Billy cried very little, though he often saw things worth crying about, and in that respect, at least, he resembled the Christ of the carol. The cattle are lowing, the baby awakes, but the little Lord Jesus, no crying he makes. Billy traveled in time back to the hospital in Vermont. Breakfast had been eaten and cleared away, and Professor Rumford was reluctantly becoming interested in Billy as a human being. Rumford questioned Billy gruffly, satisfied himself that Billy really had been interested. He asked Billy what it had been like, and Billy told him about the horses and the couple picnicking on the moon. The story ended this way. Billy and the doctors unharnessed the horses, but the horses wouldn't go anywhere. Their feet hurt too much. And then Russians came on motorcycles, and they arrested everybody but the horses. 2 days after that, Billy was turned over to the Americans, who shipped him home on a very slow freighter called the Lucretia A. Mott. Lucretia A. Mott was a famous American suffragette. She was dead. So it goes. It had to be done, Rumford told Billy, speaking of the destruction of Dresden. I know, said Billy. That's war. I know. I'm not complaining. It must have been hell on the ground. It was, said Billy Pilgrim. Pity the men who had to do it. I do. You must have had mixed feelings there on the ground. It was all right, said Billy. Everything is all right. And everybody has to do exactly what he does. I learned that on Tralfamador. Billy Pilgrim's daughter took him home later that day, put him to bed in his house, turned the magic fingers on. There was a practical nurse there. Billy wasn't supposed to work or even leave the house, for a while at least. He was under observation. But Billy sneaked out while the nurse wasn't watching, and he drove to New York City, where he hoped to appear on television. He was going to tell the world about the lessons of Tralfamador. Billy Pilgrim checked into the Royalton Hotel on 44th Street in New York. He by chance was given a room which had once been the home of George Jean Nathan, the critic and editor. Nathan, according to the earthling concept of time, had died back in 1958,
According to the Tralfamadorian concept, of course, Nathan was still alive somewhere and always would be. The room was small and simple, except that it was on the top floor and had French doors, which opened onto a terrace as large as the room, and beyond the parapet of the terrace was the airspace over 44th Street. Billy now leaned over that parapet, looked down at all the people moving hither and yon. They were jerky little scissors. They were a lot of fun. It was a chilly night, and Billy came indoors after a while, closed the French doors. Closing those doors reminded him of his honeymoon. There had been French doors on the Cape Ann love nest of his honeymoon. Still were. Always would be. Billy turned on his television set, clicking its channel selector around and around. He was looking for programs on which he might be allowed to appear, but it was too early in the evening for programs that allowed people with peculiar opinions to speak out. It was only a little after 8 o'clock, so all the shows were about silliness or murder. So it goes. Billy left his room, went down the slow elevator, walked over to Times Square, looked into the window of a tawdry bookstore. In the window were hundreds of books about fucking and buggery and murder, and a street guide to New York City, and a model of the Statue of Liberty with a thermometer on it. Also in the window, speckled with soot and fly shit, were four paperback novels by Billy's friend, Kilgore Trout. The news of the day, meanwhile, was being written in a ribbon of lights on a building to Billy's back. The window reflected the news. It was about power and sports and anger and death. So it goes. Billy went into the bookstore. A sign in there said that adults only were allowed in the back. There were peep shows in the back that showed movies of young women and men with no clothes on. It cost a quarter to look into a machine for 1 minute. There were still photographs of naked young people for sale back there, too. You could take those home. The stills were a lot more Tralfamadorian than the movies, since you could look at them whenever you wanted to, and they wouldn't change. 20 years in the future, those girls would still be young, would still be smiling or smoldering or simply looking stupid, with their legs wide open. Some of them were eating lollipops and bananas. They would still be eating those. And the peckers of the young men would still be semi-erect, and their muscles would be bulging like cannonballs. But Billy Pilgrim wasn't beguiled by the back of the store. He was thrilled by the Kilgore Trout novels in the front. The titles were all new to him, or he thought they were. Now he opened one. It seemed all right for him to do that. Everybody else in the store was pawing things. The name of the book was The Big Board. He got a few paragraphs into it, and then he realized that he had read it before, years ago, in the Veterans Hospital. It was about an earthling man and woman who were kidnapped by extraterrestrials. They were put on display in a zoo on a planet called Zircon 212. These fictitious people in the zoo had a big board supposedly showing stock market quotations and commodity prices along one wall of their habitat, and a news ticker and a telephone that was supposedly connected to a brokerage on Earth. The creatures on Zircon 212 told their captives that they had invested $1 million for them back on Earth, and that it was up to the captives to manage it so that they would be fabulously wealthy when they returned to Earth. The telephone and the big board and the ticker were all fakes, of course. They were simply stimulants to make the Earthlings perform vividly for the crowds at the zoo, to make them jump up and down and cheer or gloat or sulk or tear their hair, to be scared shitless or to feel as contented as babies in their mother's arms. The Earthlings did very well on paper. That was part of the rigging, of course. And religion got mixed up in it, too. The news ticker reminded them that the President of the United States had declared National Prayer Week and that everybody should pray. The Earthlings had had a bad week on the market before that. They had lost a small fortune in olive oil futures, so they gave praying a whirl. It worked. Olive oil went up. Another Kilgore Trout book there in the window was about a man who built a time machine so he could go back and see Jesus. It worked, and he saw Jesus when Jesus was only 12 years old. Jesus was learning the carpentry trade from his father. Two Roman soldiers came into the shop with a mechanical drawing on papyrus of a device they wanted built by sunrise the next morning. It was a cross to be used in the execution of a rabble-rouser. Jesus and his father built it. They were glad to have the work. And the rabble-rouser was executed on it. So it goes. The bookstore was run by seeming quintuplets, by five short, bald men chewing unlit cigars that were sopping wet. They never smiled, and each one had a stool to perch on. They were making money running a paper and celluloid whorehouse. They didn't have hard-ons. Neither did Billy Pilgrim. Everybody else did. It was a ridiculous store, all about love and babies. The clerks occasionally told somebody to buy or get out, not to just look and look and look and paw and paw. Some of the people were looking at each other instead of the merchandise. A clerk came up to Billy and told him the good stuff was in the back, that the books Billy was reading were window dressing. "That ain't what you want, for Christ's sake," he told Billy. "What you want's in back." So Billy moved a little farther back, but not as far as the part for adults only. He moved because of absent-minded politeness, taking a trout book with him, the one about Jesus and the time machine. The time traveler in the book went back to Bible times to find out one thing in particular: whether or not Jesus had really died on the cross, or whether he'd been taken down while still alive, whether he had really gone on living. The hero had a stethoscope along. Billy skipped to the end of the book, where the hero mingled with the people who were taking Jesus down from the cross. The time traveler was the first one up the ladder, dressed in clothes of the period, and he leaned close to Jesus so people couldn't see him use the stethoscope, and he listened. There wasn't a sound inside the emaciated chest cavity. The Son of God was dead as a doornail. So it goes. The time traveler, whose name was Lance Corwin, also got to measure the length of Jesus, but not to weigh him. Jesus was 5 feet and 3.5 inches long. Another clerk came up to Billy and asked him if he was going to buy the book or not, and Billy said that he wanted to buy it, please. He had his back to a rack of paperback books about oral genital contacts from ancient Egypt to the present and so on, and the clerk supposed Billy was reading one of these, so he was startled when he saw what Billy's book was. He said, "Jesus Christ, where'd you find this thing?" and so on, and he had to tell the other clerks about the pervert who wanted to buy the window dressing. The other clerks already knew about Billy. They'd been watching him, too. The cash register, where Billy waited for his change, was near a bin of old girly magazines. Billy looked at one out of the corner of his eye, and he saw this question on its cover: what really became of Montana Wildhack? So Billy read it. He knew where Montana Wildhack really was, of course. She was back on Tralfamador, taking care of the baby. But the magazine, which was called Midnight Pussycats, promised that she was wearing a cement overcoat under 30 fathoms of salt water in San Pedro Bay. So it goes. Billy wanted to laugh. The magazine, which was published for lonesome men to jerk off to, ran the story so it could print pictures taken from blue movies which Montana had made as a teenager. Billy did not look too closely at these. They were grainy things, soot and chalk. They could have been anybody. Billy was again directed to the back of the store, and he went this time. A jaded sailor stepped away from a movie machine while the film was still running. Billy looked in, and there was Montana Wildhack alone on a bed, peeling a banana. The picture clicked off. Billy did not want to see what happened next, and a clerk importuned him to come over and see some really hot stuff they kept under the counter for connoisseurs. Billy was mildly curious as to what could possibly have been kept hidden in such a place. The clerk leered and showed him. It was a photograph of a woman and a Shetland pony. They were attempting to have sexual intercourse between two Doric columns in front of velvet draperies, which were fringed with deedly balls. Billy didn't get onto television in New York that night, but he did get onto a radio talk show. There was a radio station right next to Billy's hotel. He saw its call letters over the entrance of an office building, so he went in.
He went up to the studio on an automatic elevator, and there were other people up there waiting to go in. They were literary critics, and they thought Billy was one too. They were going to discuss whether the novel was dead or not. So it goes. Billy took his seat with the others around a golden oak table with a microphone all his own. The master of ceremonies asked him his name and what paper he was from. Billy said he was from the Ilium Gazette. He was nervous and happy. "If you're ever in Cody, Wyoming," he told himself, "just ask for Wild Bob." Billy put his hand up at the very first part of the program, but he wasn't called on right away. Others got in ahead of him. One of them said that it would be a nice time to bury the novel, now that a Virginian, 100 years after Appomattox, had written Uncle Tom's Cabin. Another one said that people couldn't read well enough anymore to turn print into exciting situations in their skulls, so that authors had to do what Norman Mailer did, which was to perform in public what he had written. The master of ceremonies asked people to say what they thought the function of the novel might be in modern society, and one critic said, "To provide touches of color in rooms with all white walls." Another one said, "To describe blowjobs artistically." Another one said, "To teach wives of junior executives what to buy next and how to act in a French restaurant." And then Billy was allowed to speak. Off he went, in that beautifully trained voice of his, telling about the flying saucers and Montana wild hack and so on. He was gently expelled from the studio during a commercial. He went back to his hotel room, put a quarter into the Magic Fingers machine connected to his bed, and he went to sleep. He traveled in time back to Tralfamador. "Time traveling again," said Montana. It was artificial evening in the dome. She was breastfeeding their child. "Hmm?" said Billy. "You've been time traveling again. I can always tell." "Where did you go this time?" "It wasn't the war. I can tell that, too." "New York." "The Big Apple." "Hmm?" "That's what they used to call New York."
"Oh.
You see any plays or movies?"
"No. I walked around Times Square some, bought a book by Kilgore Trout."
"Lucky you."
She did not share his enthusiasm for Kilgore Trout.
Billy mentioned casually that he had seen part of a blue movie she had made. Her response was no less casual. It was Tralfamadorian and guilt-free. "Yes," she said, "and I've heard about you and the war, about what a clown you were, and I've heard about the high school teacher who was shot. He made a blue movie with the firing squad." She moved the baby from one breast to the other, because the moment was so structured that she had to do so. There was a silence. "They're playing with the clocks again," said Montana, rising, preparing to put the baby into its crib. She meant that their keepers were making the electric clocks in the dome go fast, then slow, then fast again, and watching the little earthling family through peepholes. There was a silver chain around Montana Wildhack's neck. Hanging from it, between her breasts, was a locket containing a photograph of her alcoholic mother, a grainy thing, soot and chalk. It could have been anybody. Engraved on the outside of the locket were these words: "God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom always to tell the difference." Chapter 10. Robert Kennedy, whose summer home is 8 miles from the home I live in all year round, was shot 2 nights ago. He died last night. So it goes. Martin Luther King was shot a month ago. He died too. So it goes. And every day my government gives me a count of corpses created by military science in Vietnam. So it goes. My father died many years ago now, of natural causes. So it goes. He was a sweet man. He was a gun nut, too. He left me his guns. They rust. On Tralfamador, says Billy Pilgrim, there isn't much interest in Jesus Christ. The earthling figure who is most engaging to the Tralfamadorian mind, he says, is Charles Darwin, who taught that those who die are meant to die, that corpses are improvements. So it goes. The same general idea appears in The Big Board by Kilgore Trout. The flying saucer creatures who capture Trout's hero ask him about Darwin. They also ask him about golf. If what Billy Pilgrim learned from the Tralfamadorians is true, that we will all live forever, no matter how dead we may sometimes seem to be, I'm not overjoyed. Still, if I'm going to spend eternity visiting this moment and that, I'm grateful that so many of those moments are nice. One of the nicest ones in recent times was my trip back to Dresden with my old war buddy, O'Hare. We took a Hungarian Airlines plane from East Berlin. The pilot had a handlebar mustache. He looked like Adolf Monjou. He smoked a Cuban cigar while the plane was being fueled. When we took off, there was no talk of fastening seatbelts. When we were up in the air, a young steward served us rye bread and salami and butter and cheese and white wine. The folding tray in front of me would not open out. The steward went into the cockpit for a tool, came back with a beer can opener. He used it to pry out the tray. There were only 6 other passengers. They spoke many languages. They were having nice times, too. East Germany was down below, and the lights were on. I imagined dropping bombs on those lights, those villages and cities and towns. O'Hare and I never expected to make any money, and here we were now, extremely well-to-do. "If you're ever in Cody, Wyoming," I said to him lazily, "just ask for Wild Bob." O'Hare had a little notebook with him, and printed in the back of it were postal rates and airline distances and the altitudes of famous mountains and other key facts about the world. He was looking up the population of Dresden, which wasn't in the notebook, when he came across this, which he gave me to read. "On an average, 324,000 new babies are born into the world every day. During that same day, 10,000 persons, on an average, will have starved to death or died from malnutrition." So it goes. "In addition, 123,000 persons will die for other reasons." So it goes. "This leaves a net gain of about 191,000 each day in the world. The Population Reference Bureau predicts that the world's total population will double to 7 billion before the year 2000. "I suppose they will all want dignity," I said. "I suppose," said O'Hare. Billy Pilgrim was meanwhile traveling back to Dresden too, but not in the present. He was going back there in 1945, 2 days after the city was destroyed. Now Billy and the rest were being marched into the ruins by their guards. I was there. O'Hare was there. We had spent the past 2 nights in the blind innkeeper's stable. Authorities had found us there. They told us what to do. We were to borrow picks and shovels and crowbars and wheelbarrows from our neighbors. We were to march with these implements to such and such a place in the ruins, ready to go to work. There were barricades on the main roads leading into the ruins. Germans were stopped there. They were not permitted to explore the moon. Prisoners of war from many lands came together that morning at such and such a place in Dresden. It had been decreed that here was where the digging for bodies was to begin. So the digging began. Billy found himself paired as a digger with a Maori who had been captured at Tobruk. The Maori was chocolate brown. He had whirlpools tattooed on his forehead and his cheeks. Billy and the Maori dug into the inert, unpromising gravel of the moon. The materials were loose, so there were constant little avalanches. Many holes were dug at once. Nobody knew yet what there was to find. Most holes came to nothing, to pavement or to boulders so huge they would not move. There was no machinery. Not even horses or mules or oxen could cross the moonscape. And Billy and the Maori and others helping them with their particular hole came at last to a membrane of timbers laced over rocks which had wedged together to form an accidental dome. They made a hole in the membrane. There was darkness and space under there. A German soldier with a flashlight went down into the darkness, was gone a long time. When he finally came back, he told a superior on the rim of the hole that there were dozens of bodies down there. They were sitting on benches. They were unmarked. So it goes. The superior said that the opening in the membrane should be enlarged, and that a ladder should be put in the hole so that the bodies could be carried out. Thus began the first corpse mine in Dresden. There were hundreds of corpse mines operating by and by. They didn't smell bad at first, were wax museums. But then the bodies rotted and liquefied, and the stink was like roses and mustard gas. So it goes. The Maori Billy had worked with died of the dry heaves after having been ordered to go down into that stink and work. He tore himself to pieces, throwing up and throwing up. So it goes. So a new technique was devised. Bodies weren't brought up anymore. They were cremated by soldiers with flamethrowers right where they were. The soldiers stood outside the shelters, simply sent the fire in. Somewhere in there, the poor old high school teacher, Edgar Derby, was caught with a teapot he'd taken from the catacombs. He was arrested for plundering. He was tried and shot. So it goes. And somewhere in there was springtime. The corpse mines were closed down. The soldiers all left to fight the Russians. In the suburbs, the women and children dug rifle pits. Billy and the rest of his group were locked up in the stable in the suburbs. And then, one morning, they got up to discover that the door was unlocked. World War II in Europe was over. Billy and the rest wandered out onto the shady street. The trees were leafing out. There was nothing going on out there, no traffic of any kind. There was only one vehicle, an abandoned wagon drawn by two horses. The wagon was green and coffin-shaped. Birds were talking. One bird said to Billy Pilgrim, "Pootie-weet?"
This has been an Audible Studios production of Slaughterhouse-Five, written by Kurt Vonnegut, performed by James Franco. Executive producers Lee Jarrett and Mike Charzik. Producer Bruce Katovich. Directed by Bruce Katovich. Edited, mixed, and mastered by Darren Vermas. Copyright 1969 by Kurt Vonnegut. Production copyright 2015 by Audible Inc. Audible Studios is a division of Audible Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.